Accession number 10180, Reel 7.
John Hatfield, Reel 7. When you joined the boat at, I think, St. Helens on the Clyde, how many of the crew were there?
I don't remember exactly, but I think probably not all. I think a lot of them were on leave, as the boat had just been recently built and had been doing some trials and so on. It wasn't necessary to have them all. But they all joined soon after I got there.
Do you remember anything about the crew and any particular characters or...
Of course, this was my first experience as an officer, and instantly I had less to do with the crew. We were kept apart. We had a very small wardroom, and the only contact I had was from now on was official. Although, in fact, of course, we did talk together and mix, because in such a small boat you have to. And the discipline was very relaxed. But I had less interaction with them, off-duty, for instance. So I don't remember any particular people very well, except... There was one young chap who was a bit stroppy, as we called it. In other words, he wanted to do things his own way and didn't fit in very well. And this was my first test, again, as an officer, to show my OLQ when we were all on the quayside and I thought he was slacking or not doing what he should do. And I didn't know how to tell him. And I think instead of telling him quietly, I sort of put on a kind of officer-like voice and told him to get on with it. And I remember... his expression of contempt, which showed me I'd done it all wrong. And there was a senior... The senior petty officer was called a coxswain in MTBs, and he was an ex-merchant navy type who was very experienced and also very educated. And the captain seemed to rely on him a lot, to the extent that he... Later, as I'll explain... he got this man to try and help me with my navigation, which was disastrous, because instead of helping me, it made things more complicated. But we'll come to that later.
His role would have been similar to the boatswain's role.
That's right. His role was to be the head of the lower deck and also to be the man who steered the boat. He literally steered it. The coxswain means the person who steers. And generally... carried the weight of everything on his shoulders. I mean, these coxswains had a very difficult job. But, of course, he didn't take the decisions. He didn't do the navigation. He didn't he didn't handle the ship. He steered it, but he didn't give orders about coming alongside and so on.
But he'd deal with the routine.
He'd deal with the routine, with the discipline. If there were any men who defaulted, who'd done something wrong, he would be in charge of bringing them up, putting them on a charge, if you like, bringing them up before the officer of the watch or whoever it was. He acted as the head of the lower deck and the interaction between the officers and the lower deck.
Were you a divisional officer? Did you have...
Yes, I did. I was in charge of a division, which meant that, for instance, if it was their job to clean the ship on that particular day, I had to see they'd done it properly.
How many men would you have in your division? Roughly.
Oh, about 10 or something like that. Yes, maybe a bit less, because yes, about 10 or of that order, 10 or 12.
Would you be responsible for their any of their personal
their welfare?
Problems?
Yes,
their welfare. Yes,
I was, but I don't remember anything coming up at that stage. Yes, one of the good things I was very full of admiration about in the Navy was this system of divisional officers, which I think is unique. I don't think they had it in the Army or the Air Force, by which a young officer would be in charge of a number of men, especially in a big ship, and they could put in a request to see him every day, or every so often you had request men and defaulters. And the request men would come up, and they could put in a request to go on compassionate leave or whatever it is, and they could actually very often bring their marital problems and personal money problems and things to him. He acted as a sort of father confessor, psychiatrist, and everything else. And that worked very well.
But nobody brought
anything. Nobody did at that stage to me.
Would
no.
you make the effort to learn their names and something about the background
oh,
of
yes.
these men?
It's just that I've forgotten. Oh, yes.
But at the time.
At the time I
know.
Did, yes. But they were all a bit shy. They were a bit shy of this, of officers generally. And I could sympathise because when I was on the lower deck, I never really made much contact with the officers.
Do you have any awareness of how what they thought of you, besides the man who gave you the look of contempt? But I mean, overall.
Well, they were surprisingly tolerant, I think. What I've always thought about since is how people will accept being given orders by somebody who doesn't really know much more about it than they do. Although they knew that I'd been trained in these navigation subjects and so on, they hadn't. They probably knew how to fire a gun better than I did, but they knew that I knew more about the theory of how to do it. And it really was amazing that they accepted this. There was a lot of class distinction in those days. It works two ways. One is that they accepted it. The other is that they were rather sort of resentful, but didn't show it. They were very polite.
You didn't have any trouble with commanding men then? I mean, only in this small scale.
Well, I didn't have to do it very much at that stage, because most of my duties were towards the captain at that stage, because I was navigating officer and responsible for signals and correspondence, all the sort of dirty work, if you like, of an officer in a ship.
What was your... we'll move on to navigation then. What was your responsibility as navigational officer?
Well, I had to keep the charts up to date, because the charts have to be constantly amended by a flow of Admiralty instructions which tell you that a buoy has been moved in a certain place or a lighthouse has gone out and so on. So I used to spend hours and hours until late at night in the small chart room correcting charts. And then I had, once we were at sea...
Did you have any trouble with that?
I didn't like doing it. It was very, very tedious, but I did it all right. Then once we were at sea, I would have to keep the plot, which means that the captain would say, we're steering, the chart room is below the bridge, so through a voice pipe you'd hear his voice saying, steering 103 degrees sub, so I'd put it down, and 20 knots, right. So every time he changed course or changed speed, he would shout down. And I was supposed to keep, draw a line and keep an exact position of where we were every 2 minutes, allowing for the wind and the tide, which I got from these Admiralty instructions. So I had to be up to date. There was a lot of paperwork. I had to be up to date reading these, knowing what the wind and tide were like at that time of year in particular places. And if you're steering northeast and the wind is blowing east, you then have to steer west of northeast in order to correct. And so all that, which technically is quite easy, is very difficult to do in a hurry. And that was what I was supposed to do.
Was it not made more difficult by the fact that a small boat like a motor torpedo boat is particularly vulnerable to...
Oh, yes.
Effects of wind, tide.
That's right. A lot of it is guesswork. And I think I relied a bit too much on a kind of feel and guesswork, thinking that that would make up for my failure to remember to draw the line in the right place sometimes. We were the senior officer's boat. See, because he was the RN commander, he had seven other boats under him. Therefore, wherever I went, they would follow, which made it even more important for me to navigate well.
We'll come to I'll come to the actual operational side of that later.
So,
and what was your other job? You said correspondence.
Correspondence. I mean, there's quite a lot of correspondence in a ship, even a small one, about victualling and new men joining and all that sort of thing. And signals kept coming in. What would be signals in a printed form, which I think nowadays would probably be on telex, constantly coming from the dockyard. And the routine that this captain laid down was that when a signal came, I had to log it, enter it in a book, and put it on a clip file, and then tell him. And I never could bring myself to do this when it seemed important. So we had quite a lot of trouble arising out of that, because he would insist that even if it said something like, the war's finished, or, you know, your ship's about to be blown up by a mine, I still had to do this procedure and tell him later.
What was it that annoyed you about this?
It just seemed idiotic. Although I, at that time I had a great admiration for naval tradition and all this sort of thing, that particular thing seemed to me just pig-headedness on his part. And so although I didn't deliberately defy him, I used to think, well, on this occasion I must use my initiative and do it differently. But he didn't like that.
Would you when you joined the boat on the Clyde, would you live? Were you living on the boat?
Yes, we were, because these D-class MTBs were just about big enough to live on board, although other MTBs weren't. So we actually lived in the... We had a little wardroom with four bunks, I think, on the sides, very, very small, and we actually slept on board. The captain had a little cabin of his own, if I remember rightly, and we ate in the wardroom. And the captain had a great passion for sardines on toast, so we used to have sardines on toast at all hours of the day.
And the captain would eat with you?
Yes, he would eat with us mostly.
Were you introduced there to any... I mean, sounds ludicrous in a small wardroom like that, but was there any... He sounds quite a stickler for protocol and this.
Yes, but not over food. No. No, we didn't have sort of ceremonial meals or anything like that. Perhaps because we were so small, and there was a special sort of atmosphere in MTBs that you were different, and we were allowed to wear white jerseys like submarines, and mostly the officers wore white jerseys. Although we still wore collar and tie, and I always had a starched collar. It seems absurd now, but I used to wear a starched collar because I thought it looked nice. Plus the fact that they keep cleaner too, because if they're floppy, they don't look nice and they get very dirty. The first lieutenant was a New Zealander, and he, of course, was exactly the opposite of a Pasa officer. I think he might have had some Maori blood. He looked as if he might have done, and he was a very different sort of person from the ones I'd mixed with. Very practical and down to earth. Always wore a very battered cap, and he was a kind of no-nonsense person with a slightly gruff manner. So I suppose you could say he was typically Australian stroke New Zealand, in that he wasn't at all posh or pusser, but very good at his work.
Did you get on well with him?
Yeah, but he never seemed to know how to mix completely. He was friendly, but he didn't kind of give much of himself. He kept very much aloof.
Who were the other officers there?
Well, there were only three of us in this boat. Now, in the other officers in the other boats were quite a mixture. One or two of them I'd actually known at Fareham in HMS Collingwood. One I always remembered because he was the grandson of Admiral Fisher, Lord Fisher, famous, and he looked a bit like him. He was sort of typical public schoolboy type. And one or two others that I'd known then had joined the same flotilla. On the whole, the great thing was that everybody was very keen, very conscious of belonging to a sort of elite group. I mean, we were rather stupid in a way, because we were it was tolerated that we were allowed, in fact, unofficially, not to do up all the buttons of our jacket. We could leave the top button undone, which again was something submariners did. So we kind of took over the same kind of role, swank.
When you lived aboard ship, who would cook the food?
We had one of the seamen was made cook. He wasn't a proper cook. It wasn't his job, but I think they took it in turns. But I think what happened was that one would be picked out and told he could be cook and officer's servant. And one I remember was called Salt, a young, very young chap. We used to hear the captain shouting for Salt, and that was him.
What else would he do besides cooking the meals? You said he was officer's servant.
Yes, he was more or less given the job of looking after the wardroom, keeping it clean, and doing a bit of service for us, but not very much. It was mainly just cooking the sardines on toast and keeping the place clean, and occasionally making slightly bigger meals like baked beans and sausages.
What about the men's accommodation? What was that like?
Well, that was very small, again, but they also lived on board. A very small mess deck with bunks around the sides, and how they all fitted in, God knows, but they somehow managed it.
Did it become slightly tense with everybody being living on top of each other, or was it all right?
Yeah, it wasn't particularly tense. No, there was a genuine feeling, even among the lower deck, that they were very proud to be in that and that they put up with the difficulties. But there was tension was relieved sometimes, partly because discipline was informal. But I remember at Christmas time, we did the old naval thing of the youngest member of the crew taking on the role of captain for a while on Christmas Day. which I thought was sort of very good. And it happened to be this chap Salt, and he really did it beautifully, because he did a captain's rounds, which was something the captain normally did. Captain's rounds is when he went round and inspected the boat to see it was clean. So Salt came round, and somebody shouted out, "Captain's rounds, attention!" We all had to stand to attention. And he went round, looked at the very tiny bathroom we had, washroom for the officers, and ran his finger under the basin and said, "This is filthy! Get it cleaned!" You know, this kind of thing. He did it beautifully. Of course, the fact is that he'd been the one who cleaned it, I suppose, was part of the joke. But that kind of slightly informal atmosphere made things better.
Were there any other elements to that Christmas celebrations? Would you serve a meal to the men, or was that sort of
in
thing?
Theory we did, but I'm not sure whether we did or not, because it was so small. I think we probably went round and wished them a happy Christmas and so on, but didn't serve it formally, because they were all sitting on the floor or on the deck or in various informal places. They didn't have a proper table to eat at with a set meal.
Did the fact that the MTB 621 was a new ship, did it cause any problems during the trials and such like?
Well, it meant that we had to learn to use it in a different way from other MTBs, but since we were all new anyway, including the captain, because he had previously served in big ships, and that's one reason why he had a semi-big ship routine by comparison to some captains, we all had to learn to use it in a different way. So once it was ready to join the rest of the flotilla, we just took off. And I said earlier it was the first boat of its kind. I'm not too sure now, because the other boats in the flotilla were waiting for it. But anyway, it was the first flotilla of its kind.
So where did you join the flotilla?
We, in Great Yarmouth, we had to sail practically right round the coast of Britain. We sailed from the Clyde, and I remember that very clearly, going down the Clyde. And then we put in at various ports on the way, for instance, Milford Haven, Portland, Weymouth, and so on. And we put in for a day or so and then took off again and went on.
What were its seagoing qualities like?
Not bad. MTBs were not supposed to go out in really rough weather, above a certain force C, which I'm not sure of now, because they were too fragile, and in any case they wouldn't go very well. They couldn't go slowly. They were built to go fast. We couldn't really go at much below 20 knots, except with some difficulty, although you could actually crawl along at a few knots for a short time. So when we went round the coast, it behaved very well, and the weather was quite good, luckily, so we had no problems.
Did you go straight to Great Yarmouth?
No, we stopped on the way at HMSB in Weymouth, which was the training place for the operational training base for coastal forces.
How do you spell that? HMS?
B, the insect, B-double-E. Because they were all called after insects, on the grounds that torpedo boats and things like that are like little insects, you see. So that was a wonderful place run by a retired commander, I think, certainly a retired regular officer, where you practiced actually going out in groups and attacking boats, as well as practicing a lot of other things like navigation, firing torpedoes, etc. And I went back to Weymouth a little while ago, and it's strange how little it's changed. We just used to be tied up alongside in the river estuary, the little tiny harbour there, and one of the hotels had been taken over as the base where we had lectures.
Now, to take these things, the navigational training, were you by now becoming aware of, during this training, that you were having a bit of a bother?
Yes, but I put it down to the fact that I was always bad at arithmetic, and that anything to do with figures completely threw me, bewildered me to some extent. But I don't think I was much worse than a lot of other people. I just had more responsibility as senior officer's navigation officer.
You were very conscious of it then?
Not very, but a bit. Yeah. You tended to push things like that into the background of your mind. I enjoyed very much the idea that the tactical manoeuvres that were being worked out. It was all new, you see.
What were the tactical?
Well,
you remember anything?
Yes. It had been worked out by a number of pioneers like Hitchens and Dickens. They're all quite well known young commanders of the early MTBs. that the best way to attack a convoy or a ship by an MTB was from the forward quarter, in other words, from roughly 45 degrees from the front of the boat, of the ship, and that you had to get very close. The best way was to fire it at about 200 yards. Fire, go at full speed, fire, and then turn away at full speed. Sometimes this would be done from two sides, and sometimes in cooperation with gunboats, which were the same kind of boat but armed with heavier quick-firing guns instead of torpedoes. So all these things were worked out and practiced.
You say you approached from perhaps two quarters. Would you
I used the wrong word. It's the quarter is the stern part of the ship. It's from the forward, from the bows, really.
You'd approach from the front. Would you fire both torpedoes at once, or...?
Not always, no, sometimes, but it depended on the captain's judgment. If he thought he could have another attack, he'd fire them separately to give an extra chance of hitting it.
Did you aim the torpedo by aiming the ship?
Yes, you aimed the torpedo. It was an extremely simple and primitive sight, which was invented, I think, worked out. On the bridge, there was a little metal bar that swiveled, which the captain would line up parallel with what he thought was the course of the enemy, and then on the bar there was a little thing that's a sort of in knob that slid along so that he could allow for the effect of the relative speeds. So you ended up with something, some sights that were pointing you off in a certain direction, which if you were right, would give you the proper course, that will give you the proper angle for the torpedo to go. And you then just steered your boat towards the enemy using this sight as near as you could get, and then just press the tit, as it was called, very sexist. You just press a button which fired the torpedo. And you practiced doing that, of course.
You actually fired dummy torpedoes?
Yes, sometimes, yes. And the first command I ever had at sea was to go in an old trawler and pick up some torpedoes that had got lost. In fact, there were two trawlers with a kind of drag between them, and I was told to go and find the torpedoes. Luckily, the trawler was manned by a very old fisherman who knew what he was doing, and he just did it.
What about the depth that the torpedoes went at? Would that just, once they'd fired, they'd just go at a standard...
Yes, they were set. They were set to fire at a certain... To swim at a certain depth, and the impact part of it was also adjusted. It was called the pistol, but usually they just fired on it. They just fired on impact, and all you had to do was to aim it at the right way, in the right way. Set the torpedo was previously set usually to fire at a certain depth. It just fell in the water, went along very shallow, and hit the target with any luck.
Were there any other tactics that had been...
Yes, the other one, which always struck me as very dashing, which we never used, was, some people did, was to go right in, cut across the bows of the enemy about a few yards away, and as you passed, drop a depth charge, set to go off at a very, very shallow depth. And if you did it right, it would just blow the front of the enemy ship off and wouldn't blow you off if you went away fast enough. That was one. And of course we practiced firing with machine guns and even hand grenades and all sorts of things like that.
You had hand grenades?
We practiced throwing hand grenades. And but the two main tactics were the ones I've described. We also got some kind of training at some point in boarding ship, but that wasn't a big part of it.
What training would that involve?
I don't think that was the HMS B, but we were given this rudimentary training in firing a submachine gun and throwing hand grenades. We never were trained in firing a pistol, though I had a huge Colt pistol. Not at that stage, I think. We had actually seen cutlasses, but we were never trained to use them. But we did have them on board, and sometimes.
What, on board the...
On board the MTB, I'm not sure. We might have done in the big one, yes, in the D-class one. But cutlasses are more to do with Whale Island, which perhaps I can talk of separately.
One thing I missed out, what speed would you be going at when you did these battle tactics?
Well, the top speed was about 40 knots. It depended on the boat, on the type of boat and on its condition and so on, but approximately 40. It was very difficult to get beyond that.
Did they train you with other MTBs to sort of simulate the speed of the E-boats, German? In other words,
I don't think we did that. No, I don't think we did that. We probably didn't have enough time. The problem with the E-boats was that they were much faster than we were. They had diesel engines. And although they didn't look fast, because they had a very strange shape, they were faster. And that was one problem we always had. And the great thing was to try and capture an E-boat, which was done, actually.
So any other aspects of this training at HMS B?
Well, we did night training, which meant doing all this at night, because most of the attacks took place at night. It meant using tracer of different colours, which was used, and it's quite confusing when you first use it.
Why of different colours?
Partly to show which boat you were, which flotilla you were in, and so on. It wasn't very complicated. And we practiced signalling too, in a special way, because obviously the whole point of MTBs was that they would creep up onto the enemy coast unobserved, lie there with the engines off, usually, until something came up, and then roar into action. So we practiced crash starts, and we practiced signalling to other boats in the flotilla with a little lamp, with a very small, feeble light, usually using just a single letter, like J might mean creep up, and L might mean go away, and this kind of thing, fall back.
What about searchlights? Did you have a searchlight on board?
We had searchlights, yes. I don't think we practiced them, it was just considered something you could use. We also had special flag signals, which were different from the normal naval ones, simplified, because we had a very small mast, but we could use a very simple system of flag signals. The whole idea was that each flotilla or sub-flotilla would act very quickly, and that we were there using our own initiative and not using cumbersome naval tactics and deployment and so on. Yeah, a lot of interesting people at Weymouth, because there are all kinds of boats there. One lot that I remember seeing was the Free French. There was a Free French MTB flotilla, which I joined later, and I remember seeing some of the officers lined up on the quayside, including de Gaulle's son, who looked exactly like a very young version of General de Gaulle, very tall. And I spoke to them because I was interested in French people. The other person I met there was Peter Scott in his steam gunboat flotilla, which was the only one. And I didn't know him well, but he struck me as an interesting person, and it was quite interesting that such a famous person was among us.